You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. You can find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. How do we care for, how do we include, are we inclusive of those with disabilities in our congregations and congregational life and spiritual care? How do we overlook some individuals simply because they might have a disability or they might approach something in a way that's different than how we might approach it? We'll address some of those questions today. We'll talk with Mona Furstenau, Director of Lutheran Ministry Partnerships for Bethesda Lutheran Communities, and a frequent guest here on Faith and Family. Mona, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me today. It's fun to be in the studio instead of via telephone.
Glad to have you here. And you're here in St. Louis because you're involved in an event here in St. Louis. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Glad that you had some time to come visit us here at KFUO Studios. Tell me a little bit about Bethesda Lutheran Communities and your specific work as Director of Lutheran Ministry Partnerships.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to share more about Bethesda's mission and ministry. We have been in existence for 114 years, headquartered in Watertown, Wisconsin, providing residential services, spiritual supports, and vocational skill supports for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We're in 14 states. We have nearly 2,500 people that we support across the country and staff that provide whatever level of care they need or support that they need in their programs, in their homes, in their vocational skill. I'm part of the Religious Life Department. We have 14 ministry consultants and four other directors, and my role is to share the mission and ministry of Bethesda nationally. I do a lot of speaking at conferences, preparing workshops and presenting and talking about how to be more inclusive, how to break down barriers in faith communities and in congregations around supporting people with disabilities. So I do that nationally. But I also still have my finger in that consulting piece that I started with at Bethesda. So when we get a request for information or support from a congregation in a state or an area where we do not have people we support in programs or we do not have religious life staff, then I go there and provide consultation and help them break down those barriers and become places of welcome and inclusion.
Why has this topic been important to you? Why did you get involved with Bethesda?
Oh, it's a long story. I'll give you the short version. I have a degree in speech and language pathology and worked in that field for 13 years. So I've always been interested in working with people with disabilities. Then I had my children, both very diverse learners on opposite ends of the spectrum of ability. And they've really been my best teachers and my biggest teachers. So I'm passionate about inclusion and about developing community for people with different abilities because that's been my experience. So my son is now 25, my daughter's 28. So I have a lot of experience in walking alongside, educating, equipping, sharing, casting vision, asking questions about how we might do this better. And I do believe that as a church, as a country, but as a church specifically, we can do better. And the church at large, not just the Lutheran church, but the church at large has marginalized people with disabilities or been paternalistic instead of seeing them as having value, dignity, affording them respect and a place in the family. So
your work with Bethesda and your own personal mission is to see that change, to be inclusive as a church of people with all different types of abilities.
And not just inclusive, but to share that idea that people with disabilities have value to offer, that we're all individually gifted, even and including people with disabilities, and that God can use all of those gifts to enrich the community in which people are interacting. And so that, I think, is my ultimate passion, is to broaden that perspective and that vision and that understanding that people with disabilities have something to bring, offer, contribute, and a meaningful participation is important to the rest of us, to all of us.
When did you start seeing that to be an issue? When did you realize in the congregation, in the life of the congregation, that perhaps we're not doing the best that we could when it comes to spiritual care or even expectations of people with disabilities and how we expect them to be a part of congregational life, how we expect them to share in responsibilities that we have in the church.
I think it's been unfolding for years that my personal family experience has been similar to many. It mirrors sort of the experience of many families with disabilities who are families of faith, who long for that place of belonging, who long for that place of sanctuary, but who've run into barriers or who've been hurt by attitudes or lack of willingness by their faith community to include, embrace, support, recognize, value. And I think it's just been a unfolding journey for me to recognize how broad that was, that it wasn't just my family's experience or my immediate friends and family's experience, but that broadly in this country and around the world, that marginalization of people with disabilities exists in every arena, and the church is no exception to that. Did I answer the question?
Yes. But I think we can dig deeper. I want to, as we were talking about people with different, all different types of abilities, that they have the value and they also have, they have vocations as well, that God uses them in the church as well. And I always think of John chapter 9 when this comes up. When as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him."
Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories. And it's not, I like to add on to that story to say, it's not just because he was healed that God's glory was revealed. For those who are not healed of their physical disabilities, they still can bring that sense of awe and wonder and glory of God to a congregation. And can I share a little story about my son and that maybe
sure.
illustrate it?
Yeah.
So my son loves music. We're a very musical family. We are not athletic. And he is part of this family, so he's very musical. He loves music, and he is passionate about getting his whole body into it. So if you can imagine air guitars, air drums, conducting like a symphony conductor whenever there's music present. So as he was growing up, I got involved in the children's ministry music ministry at our congregation, and he was always right by my side. He's not able to sing, not able to play an instrument, but he loves music and he gets his whole body into it. So he was my apprentice conductor and grew up that way and was standing next to me conducting the children in their music. And his interest in music just continued. And as he got passionate and more knowledgeable about instruments, people would gift us with instruments. We now have 50 plus instruments in our house that people said, "Oh, I had the trombone from high school. We don't use it anymore. Would you want it for Ben?" And I said, "Sure." That collection of instruments has become now a resource for him. And he began to share in our preschool at our church, bringing an instrument for the kids to try and see and look at. We bring a recording of it being played well so they can hear what it really sounds like. That participation of him serving at our preschool in our church led to a connection with someone else in our congregation who works at the community college. And long story short, he now has a position. He's been there for 4 years, leading music experience classes with preschoolers at the community college campus, because that's his passion and that's his gifting. And I can't tell you how many times he's in church rocking out to the praise team, and the praise team and others are smiling and enjoying the music in a new way because of the way that he enjoys God's gift of music.
So he has multiple vocations, and he has ways in which to serve that are very fitting for the ways that he is gifted.
Exactly. And isn't that how we all should be participating in our faith communities, using our gifts? And
earlier you mentioned barriers. You know, so in congregation, sometimes we face barriers, and so that sometimes hinders us, discourages us from inviting someone to participate in a particular way, or perhaps even discourages us from asking someone to serve in a particular way because we think that their disability may prevent them from doing whatever it is we're asking them to do. Maybe they'll have to do it differently.
I think it's true that for most congregations and most people I talk with, it's not that they're unwilling. They just don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems so basic, and it is so basic to just say, just ask. Ask, what is it that you want to do? How is it that you want to be involved? What gifts do you bring? How do you want to share them? What supports do you need to do that? And let's just figure it out together. It's really very easy. But the barriers are often fear of the unknown, fear of saying the wrong thing or mm-hmm. insulting someone. And I think those are easily overcome by just being frank and honest. I don't know how to do this. I don't know what you need. Let's just talk about it. Because I recognize that you have gifts you can share and bring.
Tell me a little bit about the workshop that you're involved in this week here in St. Louis.
Oh, I'm so excited about this. So this is the annual conference of TASH, T-A-S-H. It's an advocacy organization. It's been in existence for about 41 years. Primarily started with advocacy in public schools around special education services. At that time when special ed was created through a public law and a mandate. And so they've done that kind of advocacy and moved from that into public policy work and then across the lifespan. And I think for a long time, churches and faith communities just really weren't on their radar in terms of a spot that advocacy might be needed. Some research in the last few years out of Vanderbilt University from Dr. Eric Carter, he's really the only one doing research around faith and people with disabilities, has really brought to light the difference between what parents and families want and what faith communities are actually providing, and that there needs to be education, equipping, and advocacy around access to faith communities and participation in faith communities. Bethesda is sponsoring that Faith and Inclusion Workshop along with a number of programs from the Catholic Archdiocese here in St. Louis. We'll be sharing individual workshops, five different ones, and then a panel discussion around equipping congregations, equipping Christian schools for inclusion of people with disabilities and support of their families. And so one of the main topics is dear to my heart and that I'm passionate about is about supporting the family. So the workshop that I'm presenting primarily by myself tomorrow is that the whole family matters when we're talking about faith communities and people with disabilities.
How so? Tell me a little bit more.
Each person in the family experiences that disability journey differently. No one chose it. And each part of the family is affected differently. So you have the person with a disability who has that disability and lives that. As a child, they may be unaware of what that means. As an adult, they may be more aware about what that means in terms of participation and barriers and difference and attitudes and so forth. The parents, we often talk about needing support, but they really experience it differently. And so the mothers often, and I am one, so I speak from experience, the mothers often feel guilt, feel overwhelmed, feel tired, tired of advocating and just simply tired, torn between other children they may have, finding time for the marriage. And so moms experience that whole process differently. Dads, on the other hand, and there's some stereotypes here, I get it, they want to fix it. They feel the need to be strong, and yet they're confused and unprepared for what being the parent or the father or the mother of a child with a disability means, or what that's going to look like. And let's be honest, there's grief. There's loss of that family dream. There's loss of that dream of who that child would have been, and that has to go through that whole grief cycle of loss and potentially anger, guilt, coming to accept. And for family with disability, that recycles over and over again every time there's a milestone missed. So when a child doesn't walk at the time of his age peers or talk or if ever talk or get a driver's license or go on a date or get married, every time those milestones of their age peers are being met, then that grief can be revisited because it's another loss and it's another difference of what the family dream was. And so we know that that mothers and fathers both process through that differently. And then there's the marriage that is affected by the stresses. It's not as bad as what we hear. There's numbers going around saying 90% of families with disabilities end in divorce. And that's not true. We know that's not true. We know that's a little bit higher than the typical general population. And we know that happens later in that marriage relationship. And we think that that has to do with the constant stress and lack of time and ability to engage and support the marriage. And this is a place I think the church can do better in supporting those families, keep those families together, strengthening those marriages, supporting those marriages and that situation. Then you have the siblings, right? In my family, I have a daughter, an older daughter, who is wonderful with all of the disability pieces, but quite honestly, there's a lot to her that's not about disability. And often what happens in a family is that the whole life, the whole family life revolves around disability. And that's not fair to the other siblings who don't have a disability. There can be anger, there can be overachievement, there can be manipulation, there can be guilt and shame and so on as well. And it could just, they could just get lost. They could get lost in that whole disability piece. And so they need different supports. And then you have grandparents and extended family. And for grandparents particularly, they're grieving for their child, the parent of the grandchild, and they're grieving for their grandchild. And that whole, they're worried, they're concerned, they want, they don't know what to do. And quite honestly, for most of them and their age peers, they didn't grow up around people with disabilities. They were marginalized and not visible. And so they have no experience either with what does this mean. So each member of the family has different issues and travels through that disability life with disability in a different way.
So then how do we involve the whole family of someone with a disability in the life of a congregation and in spiritual care? How do we care for them? How do we involve that? How do we as a congregation, how do we as church workers, how do we as other families care for them, for that whole family of someone with a disability?
I think first of all, it's that awareness. We have to acknowledge this is a different journey than what they had planned and from other families in the congregation. And also to recognize that disability doesn't define each of them entirely. It's a component of that family and a component of those people's lives, but it's not everything. So as we talked earlier about being individually gifted, we really need to pay attention to what are the individual giftings of each person in the family. Is the mom an avid quilter and does she just simply not have time to do it anymore? Then can we provide the respite for her to be involved in a shared interest activity with others of shared interest, something that has nothing to do with disability, to give her that break? Same for the dad. The child, the siblings who don't have a disability can be relieved of that as a piece of their life at the congregation. Can they be involved in activities of their interest with their age peers, not supporting or helping their sibling with a disability, but given permission not to in that arena, so that we're recognizing everyone's individual gifts and letting them use them and supporting them to use them, including the person with a disability, like my son, as I said, involved in music, giving them an opportunity to serve individually in their own right.
How can within the household, within the family, what are some things we can think about to support one another? As you said, we each deal with this or perceive this disability and are affected by it in different ways. How do we support each other? within the family?
I think it's really important to get some scriptural support to refer to and to include that in your family devotions, in your family time. And again, I'm going to keep going back to that. I think it's really important within the family to recognize who's gifted in what way and to let them serve in that way. So my daughter is a very verbal communicator, and my son was not. He's still not, that's not his strong suit, shall we say. And she was frustrated by that. And so she came up with and created a number of different kinds of picture symbol communication things when they were small to help in the her interaction with her brother. And I think she was gifted in being able to create those much more than I was. Mm-hmm. I was too close to it. And she wanted to do it. And so that role that she took on of creating some things to make it easier for her to communicate with her brother was a help to the whole family. And recognizing that and acknowledging that and thanking her for that and letting her participate in a way that she was able to identify using her strengths to help the whole family, I think that's a key thing. And then thanking each other for being with each other on this journey is something I think all families need to do more. Thank mm-hmm. each other for what they do in the family.
How can we as congregations, what are some, I guess, some misconceptions that we may fall into as congregations when it comes to individuals with disabilities and their families? What are some misconceptions that we might have about their involvement in congregational life, whether it be the family or the person with the disability?
Are you asking about families that are already involved in our congregations or those that are not?
Some that are marginally involved.
Marginally involved.
You know, that they know that they want to be connected to a church, but they're really just not. They might make it on Sundays, but it's not every Sunday. They're not really involved in anything else because no one's asked them.
Or the assumption mm-hmm. by the congregation is that it's not that important to them. But the truth of the reality is it's difficult to manage all those pieces. And on any given Sunday or week, as we're heading into making choices about what we're going to spend our energy on, if there's been a crisis at the school or a medical crisis or the sibling has had some issue or the breadwinner of the family, husband or wife, has had a work issue that takes energy away from them being able to manage that, getting to church where they want to be and know that they could get some support, they just simply don't have the energy. I think often for congregations, we project that they're not that interested instead of really trying to understand what that looks like for mm-hmm. them and where they need support to do more or be involved more. So I was just talking with someone here in the building who was talking about a family who has four children, two of whom have autism. And they take turns going to church and taking the other children to Sunday school and the other stays home with the children with autism. Because the congregation has recognized, hey, we never see them all together, and has begun to say and ask them, what can we do so that you can all be here? What do you need for those other children to be able to come and be part of Sunday school? What can we do? And my bottom line is always just ask the question. As a congregation, don't assume that you understand why. Ask the question. Is there something more we can do? Is there something more you would like? What kind of support do you need? And it may not be that you can provide it, but asking that question opens that door for those family to feel comfortable to say, this is what we need. This is what we'd like. We just don't know how to get there. And then journey together to the solutions.
And I would think, you know, average Joe in the congregation would think, well, that's not for me to ask. I mean, is that a fair assumption? We would all assume, okay, well, that's the pastor's job, or that's That's the Sunday school director's job, or that's,
or they're managing it just fine. They don't
right.
I don't need to get involved. Or if they wanted something, they would ask. Yeah, I think that's a typical attitude. But let me throw this out there. If you go to visit a congregation, who do you feel good about at the end of that visit? Is it the pastor who came up and talked to you because he knew you were a visitor, or is it others in the congregation who came up and said, hey, I don't know if I've seen you here before, I'm so-and-so, welcome? I mean, if we do that for any visitor, why not do that for that family?
Mm-hmm.
It's no different. People with disabilities have the same needs for belonging, same needs for care and concern, how you doing, what do you need, as anyone else. And I think we project that's different mm-hmm. when it's a person with a disability. And it's really not.
Hmm. We're glad you came here to receive God's good gifts with us in word and sacrament. We're so glad. We know it's important. Is there anything we can do that would help you do that more frequently?
Yeah.
Or
what works for your family? Mm-hmm. What doesn't work? Is there some way we can support you?
Hmm. What do you hope to gain from the workshop that you're involved in this week?
I always get encouraged by the room full of people that's there. Those are seeking to help the church do better, to help the schools do better. Those that are there to get more confidence or more resources to begin to do more in their home community, in their home congregation. I'm always encouraged by that. I was thrilled at LEA, the Lutheran Education Association convocation in Grand Rapids. Did two workshop sessions and had planned for 50. I had 147 people in one workshop. These are Lutheran educators saying, tell us more about how to talk with families. What do we do? How do we talk with parents? How do we support them? That's thrilling for me because that means each of the folks that are there have someone or some community or some place in mind that brought them there. And if they go home and do one thing, then that's a life that's going to be touched. And I get excited by that. So I get mm-hmm. encouraged by speaking to, whether it's one or two people or a big, huge crowd, I get excited by the potential that they will do when they go home.
I would imagine every congregation has a family that's affected by a disability in some way, but potentially could have more families that are connected to their congregation, that are a part of their congregation, that are that become an important part of the congregational life, receiving those good gifts of God on a regular basis, if they knew that there was that support there to help their family be there and be a part of that on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Some of Dr. Eric Carter's work was researching families and asked 500 families, what would you like to see in your faith community and what actually exists. And the gap between those percentages is huge. What he's done is create a practical guide for congregations. And what we know is that in the general population, the children at 21 and under, about 20% of them are affected by a developmental disability. If you look at the lifespan of people with disabilities, including aging, disabilities due to aging, we know that it's about 47% of the population is affected by a disability of some sort. We also know that those with disabilities are present in congregations at about 52% of those that say they'd like to be. And so there's huge mission field. Did that make sense? Did I say that in a way that's understandable?
Well, we are... Unfortunately, we're all out of time, but we can find out more about Bethesda Lutheran Communities online as well.
Absolutely. We have all kinds of resources available for congregations around disability awareness and equipping them to help their congregations become more inclusive.
Mona Furstenau, Director of Lutheran Ministry Partnerships for Bethesda Lutheran Communities. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Oftentimes, when a woman is told the unborn child she carries suffers from a serious medical condition incompatible with life, abortion is usually recommended. Of course, that's contrary to God's plan for the baby. He has a purpose for every child conceived, even if the life is to be brief. A new study published in Prenatal Diagnosis unintentionally reinforces God's will. It says women whose babies are diagnosed with lethal medical issues are better off if they allow the baby to live and let nature take its course. Women who abort suffer significantly more despair and depression compared with those who continue the pregnancy. I believe this also affects the well-being of the fathers. We don't know why God allows these situations. We must simply trust His plan.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Have you considered making gifts to KFUO using Securities? While considering your year-end contributions to KFUO, think about other ways of giving that may offer significant tax benefits, especially with higher appreciated securities. If you have questions about using securities for gifts or other possible assets, call Mary at 314-996-1518. We'll send a representative out to help answer your questions about using non-cash assets for gifts to your favorite radio station, Worldwide KFUO.
Hi, I'm Mark Hawkinson with an invitation for you to join me over the weekday noon hour for Moments of Assurance, your lunchtime spiritual recipe. You'll enjoy encouraging scriptures, a bit of Bible history and trivia, news items, humor, the kids' corner, and more, all mixed in with faith-strengthening sacred music, a blend just right for your midday hour. So join me, won't you? That's Moments of Assurance over the weekday noontime hour here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Hi, I'm Pastor Ted Lesh, pastor at Chapel of the Cross Lutheran Church in North St. Louis County, inviting you to listen to our KFUO radio worship broadcasts on Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock. Active worship, preaching, music, and singing are part of every one of our services at Chapel. Join us Sunday nights at 6. It's one more broadcast worship opportunity for you from your friends at Chapel of the Cross and KFUO Radio.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our beloved retiree on this Friday, December 2nd, 2016. Today's celebrated retiree is Joan Harwell. Joni Harwell has spent 29 years at Worldwide KFUO, and the staff takes today to honor her for her many years of service in the name of Christ. Once again, the staff of Worldwide KFUO salutes our beloved retiree, Joni Harwell of St. Louis, Missouri.
Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, reliable and trustworthy. KFUO, your pioneer of Christian radio, AM 850 and KFUO.org. The message is clear.
You're listening to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Joining me by phone today, Deaconess Sarah Lemon. She's a deaconess, a wife, and mother, and has some thoughts and insights to share with us about young children in worship. Deaconess Sarah Lemon, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you.
So good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about, you have many hats, many vocations. What led you to consider this vocation of deaconess?
I was a student at River Forest, and I fell in love with the theology classes, and I was an education major, but I wasn't getting all of the theology classes I wanted, and I had some friends in the deaconess program, and I asked what that was, and they explained, and it just, it fit. So that's what I went with.
So you had the privilege of studying theology, and tell me about that formation of becoming a deaconess. What are how would you describe that vocation of deaconess?
There is an emphasis on serving. So it's constantly learning how best to serve your neighbor, setting aside your own desires, trying not to impose your own thoughts or advice, but really seeking out the best way to love your neighbor, whether that's in a parish, caring for other parishioners, other lay people, or supporting a pastor by getting some things off of his plate, things that not things that are unique, of course, to the pastoral office, but helping with a shut-in visit, helping to visit the sick in the hospital, things like that, and praying for your pastor, of course, which all lay people are hopefully doing. But also, I served in an institutional setting, so the way that looked was visiting residents in a nursing home in their rooms and talking about Jesus, yes, but also talking about their family, talking about their losses. They've lost their home by that point. They're living in a nursing home. They've lost their health. They've lost all sorts of things. And to steer a conversation like that back to Christ and the cross and the gifts that we have in the Lord that we will never lose, but that just keep building and building until the culmination of eternal life.
So a vocation of care and service and mercy for others, all centered in that work and life of Christ and how he so enables you to do those acts of mercy and care and service. Well, and your other vocations, wife and mother, tell me about your family.
My husband, Stan, and I met at Concordia University. I say River Forest because that's what it was called at the time. But we got married as soon as he finished his degree so that we could be married on my internship. And we have been blessed over our 10 years of marriage with three children. Our daughter, Lucille, is 7, and she is currently in first grade. Our son, Henry, is 4. He'll be 5 in 2 weeks. And he is in preschool. And then our youngest, Evelyn, is 2.5.
So a house full of, just a house full of kids and a happy, healthy family. What does Sunday morning look like for the Lemon family?
It's hectic getting everyone out the door. And once we get to church, it's a bit of a blessing. Our church is small in building size, but not in attendance. So by the time we get there at 10 till service, the only rows left unfilled are about the front 5. So it forces us up front, which is a blessing with our children because they can pay better attention. If they're up close, they can pay better attention. We have a family, a couple that's probably in the age range of our parents that are good friends of ours, and we sit with them in the pew. So then our kids are sitting with us and sitting with the other couple, and we're all helping to keep them focused on the service.
And so they've become kind of like a part of the family through your congregation and worship life. This older couple has become a part of your family in some ways, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yes.
And how do you find that to be a benefit for the children, for you, and for them, too?
We look at the service through fresh eyes. So instead of sitting down and thinking, oh, it's the same setting again this week, we're thinking of ways to get the kids' attention and things that the kids can participate in. Oh, it's the same setting this week. That's great. They're going to remember the words to this canticle, or they're going to know what's coming next. We like that reliability. And the other couple, their children are in their 20s and 30s, And now they've got a whole new set of kids, I suppose, whether they like it or not. They have R3 to also talk with during the service about the mm-hmm. service, not about other things, of course.
Sure. And I, just recently in an Advent service with our family, we have a three-year-old son, and I was asking him to find, can you find, point to the things that are blue? Can you tell me where, you know, show me where you see blue things in the sanctuary? And he was, of course, he wasn't so quiet about it. Daddy blue, daddy blue. But and we have some banners. I said, can you find the angels in the sanctuary? And so he pointed to the angels on the banners, and then trying to direct his attention to pastor and to listen for certain words. How do you talk through the service with your kids, or what do you have them looking for to engage them during the service?
We do the key words as well. We have them listen for certain words during the sermon. The sermon is the time we struggle the most to get them to pay attention so we can pay attention. There are weeks sometimes in a row that I don't get to hear what I would like to hear during the sermon because I'm distracted taking care of a little one as well. We make it a practice in our own home. I think it's really important. What you're doing in your own home plays a big part in how Sunday morning goes. So because it's a routine in our home to say the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed, it becomes something they can participate in at church. Even they can recite the Nicene Creed in church, even though that's not what we're saying every day at home.
Wow.
Just because it complements it. It's similar, but they're also hearing that every Sunday as well. Even our two-year-old can pick up on key words in those prayers. We're pretty musical. I mentioned to you that I teach music part-time, and so the kids know some of the words to canticles or just the sung responses, even if it's just amen. And they get a little bit of a charge out of getting to sing along with the whole congregation on those parts. Our seven-year-old is learning to read, so she's thrilled to have her own hymnal. And we haven't done this in a while, but we have a couple of personal hymnals that we've taken along as well because they're more child-sized, they're more child-friendly. And then they can follow along, turning pages. Even though they can't read, they can see that, oh, there's a reason that we're moving along, or oh, look at the music, or look at the beautiful pictures in our hymnal. So
there are visuals, and there's even something somewhat tactile, too, with the hymnal, something for them to hold with their hands.
Yes, absolutely. The other thing that I like to take to church is the story Bible that Concordia Publishing House puts out. This was not so much true over the summer, but now that we're back in the church year, at the beginning of the church year, we can follow along with the story each week in the book. And then it gives us this beautiful picture, this non-cartoony picture that they'll ask questions about, because not all the words make sense to them, but the pictures do. Why is this person praying? Why is this person looking sad? Things like that.
Those are deep questions. We haven't gotten to those yet. As your children grow, what are some of the milestones, some of the joys that you've seen as those milestones that they reach when it comes to paying attention to what's going on in the service?
I really enjoy when our kids say, Mommy, he said this. Our son and our daughter both go to Lutheran schools, and the teachers do a good job of teaching them about the story that's coming up in the lectionary. And so we were talking about one of the stories coming up, and they had been asking all these questions about it. And then we get to the service, and they hear the reading, and they're saying, Mommy, this is what we talked about. And they hear the sermon, and I guess we must have spoken in a doctrinally sound way, because Pastor preached about the same things that we had been discussing in our home. So that was something to rejoice in for a couple of reasons. It's also wonderful just to hear them pick up on the words, like my two-year-old folding her hands with everyone and saying evil, bread, just key words in the Lord's Prayer as we go along. It's encouraging.
You mentioned earlier how another family sits with your family and just helps. What are the ways that this this couple helps your family and helps your children particularly, and by helping them helps you? What are the ways that they do that? Just by sitting there, what is it that, you know, by them sitting there, what is it that's helping?
I find that my children are more comfortable acting out around me than they are around someone other than me. And I think this is true in most facets of life. With mom and dad, they can be comfortable and a little more rebellious, but with not a stranger, but someone else, another authority figure, they might be a little more respectful. And that seems to be true in the pew. So my two-year-old would not sit still on my lap, but she will sit still on the lap of this female friend of ours. And so then my female friend is folding her hands, encouraging Evelyn to do the same and saying prayers with her. This friend of mine also happens to be an art teacher. So she brings crayons along and she'll draw pictures and she'll compliment what pastor is saying or what we're reading that day out of the liturgy. She'll compliment that with something that she's drawn. Nothing, you know, incredibly elaborate, but maybe she'll draw a donkey because we're going to hear about Jesus, or this last Sunday, Jesus going into Jerusalem.
What do the kids call these friends that sit with your family?
We like to teach our kids to call people by their last name, so mm-hmm. Mr. and Mrs. Wheemiller.
And I'm sure that it sounds like the kids enjoy this, too. They enjoy having another family join them.
They do, very much so. And like you had mentioned, they have become family for us, like a church grandma and a church grandpa. And they come to birthday parties. We like to meet up, even just as couples. Even though they're more like our parents' age, I've found that having friends who have kind of been through it and seen out the other side of raising children is quite a blessing and can be more encouraging at times than just bonding in solidarity with other young mothers.
That was just what I was going to ask you. What do you see as the benefits of families like this connecting within a congregation where it's not a homogenous group? There are families across the age spectrum. And so there are families within this body of Christ that are connecting and supporting one another. What do you see as any other benefits that you see from that? You mentioned that you see each other outside of worship, outside of, you know, church gatherings.
Yes. There's a building one another up in love aspect, certainly. I think having worked in a nursing home for several years, it's important to me to have intergenerational interaction for my kids, even for myself. I think it gives us a new perspective. Suddenly then, instead of getting all irate about just pick an item, pick something, you have an additional perspective that can, I don't know, lighten the mood and show you that there are so many things in life that you don't need to worry about every little thing. My 2.5-year-old is not potty trained, but that's okay because we're going to get to that point. It will happen eventually. You know, there's encouragement there from someone who's been there already. I hope that makes sense.
Yes,
that may have been
too vague. How did this relationship begin? How did, you know, what broke down that wall, if there was a wall? How did this whole idea begin of your family sitting together and this mutually beneficial relationship?
You know, this particular relationship began pretty early on in our membership at this congregation. We've only been at this church about 2.5 years, and I think because of my older daughter's interest in art And the fact that I mentioned Mrs. Wiemiller is an art teacher, I think that kind of helped to spur things on. If I remember correctly, our son, Henry, who was 2 at the time, launched a Hot Wheels car in the middle of a service right between them. And I believe that that kind of started, oh, hi, we're the Lemons. But if we want to back up a little further, when before our first daughter was born, I was a church organist. So when Lucy was born, I still needed to play for our church, and that left my husband with a newborn. And this was in a different parish out in Pittsburgh. But there was a couple there, again, around the age of our parents, actually a little bit older, who would sit with my husband and then help him anytime Lucy fussed or if he needed something. And so when we came to this parish that we're at now, we knew that we needed a couple like that. We knew that we wanted a second church family, so to speak, just because it had worked so beautifully during our time when I was on the organ bench and Stan had an infant to take care of.
And much appreciated, it sounds like. What?
Yes.
How can we initiate conversations or make the most of opportunities to do that? You know, you see a young family sitting in church and you can tell it might perhaps be a struggle for them. And perhaps some of those might think, you know, this is just too difficult. It's too challenging to try to finagle 2 kids, 3 kids, even just 1 kid in divine service on Sunday. And so then the following Sunday, it's more of a challenge for them to even get there. They end up finding themselves less motivated to go. And then what do you know, a month later, they haven't been to church in 3-4 weeks because they're just reluctant to go because of the challenges they face with trying to, they're afraid that maybe others are critical of them or that they're distracting others because their child is being noisy or disruptive. What can we do to work around that?
That's a great conversation that should be had, I would hope, in each parish. For the young family, for a young mom especially, I think it's really important to remind young mothers that your own child is most likely the loudest in your ears than anyone else's. Other people are most likely not as bothered by your child as you are, first of all. I think that once we are, like as someone who I feel I'm moving out of the stage of having really small, inconsolable children, I think it's important for us to see those families with infants and with toddlers and to go and find something to compliment, to not critique them, but to say, oh, I really liked when your little one was sitting still at this point, or I really liked when your little one folded her hands, or I saw how she was looking up at Pastor during the sermon. I wonder what she might have learned from that moment, or are you talking about this with her at home? Not in a way of judging her, of course, but just to prompt, oh, I guess I could do that. I could bring something from Sunday home with me. I think we can find positive things to acknowledge in order to kind of overshadow the frustrations, because it's so easy to get caught up in everything that our kids are doing wrong that sometimes I miss when they're doing things right.
How do you think your relationship with the older couple that sits with your family, how do you think it benefits them? Or the congregation as a whole?
They tell us each week, they tell us they love our family. They tell us they love our kids. And I think that they look forward to coming each, I think they looked forward to coming each Sunday before we got there too. But I think that they look forward to having our kids sit with them, because Mrs. Wiemiller will tell me, oh, I am so excited, I got this new pad of paper for Evelyn to use during church today. Or she'll say, oh, I brought them a treat for after church, is that okay? And they like that sort of thing. I think they also enjoy the comments that my kids will make during the service, because they'll tell me things that my son or my older daughter have said to them about the service afterwards. So my son Henry will hear pastors say, refer to Satan, and he'll whisper to Mrs. Wiemiller, that means the devil. Like he'll hear these things and he'll pick up on them, and he wants to make sure that Mr. and Mrs. Wiemiller know what's going on too, which is really sweet. So I think that they are encouraged at the fact that our children are paying attention and gleaning something, because they also have other grandchildren in other congregations. And I think it encourages them for what those grandchildren might be picking up that we're not aware of.
What do you think as a congregation, you mentioned this earlier, that it was important to you that there would be an intergenerational aspect to life in the congregation. How do you think that benefits the congregation as a whole?
I think that it encourages the young mothers that their children are not a bother. But I also think it can rejuvenate the older families as well, who might be more prone to getting stuck in the way things have been or should, how they think things should be. I think it encourages dialogue. Not that I think the church should be constantly changing, but that they can find a way to rejoice in the consistency in the church, in the service as well. I think also it encourages participation. So in the parishes that we've been in, there have been older generations that have really been in charge of things and really been responsible for getting things done around the parish. But when they're in dialogue with the younger generations, and even whether that's family or not, it encourages some younger people to step up and take on leadership roles within the church. And by leadership roles, I mean just even building maintenance or directing choir or wanting to fill in on the organ bench, things like that. I think it's essential to the life of a church to have the older generations encouraging those who are younger, and to have the younger generations rejoicing in this legacy that is instilled within each parish because of our excellent Lutheran theology, because of our divine service that continually points to Christ. I think it's a necessity.
Deaconess Sarah Lemon, wife and mother, thanks so much for sharing with us your ideas and insights and just really valuable points on how we approach worship with young children. It really is an intergenerational approach. Thanks so much for being my guest today on Faith and Family.
Thank you.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.